I am an alcoholic. My name is Jane.
Welcome.
And by the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had to have a drink since the 18th of September, 1996, which for this alcoholic is a real miracle. I'd like to read a little something from the book so I know you hear at least one true thing before I do anything else. Out in a vision for you, and I don't know, it's on my phone, so it's on. Says it's on page 152. It says, we have shown how we got out from under. You say, yes, I'm willing, but am I to be consigned to a life where I shall be stupid, boring, and glum, like some righteous people I see? I know I must get along without liquor, but how can I? Have you a sufficient substitute? Yes, there is a substitute, and it is vastly more than that. It is a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. There you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. Your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. The most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead. Thus we find the fellowship, and so will you. And the reason I read that, because I love a vision for you, and as you can see, I'm still a double-fisted drinker, is I want to talk about sobriety. Telling you about my drinking is not interesting. You guys all drank. You know what you did. And it's all the same that I did. Simply for the record, by the time I came in here, I was drinking a half gallon of vodka every day. But I didn't have a problem, so. I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous because I wanted tomorrow to feel different than today did. I was suicidal. I was in extreme emotional pain. And the wheels of my life were coming apart. They were just falling off. So I had that gift of desperation, and I walked in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and there was a little retired nun who was sharing the meeting that day. I got sober in California, in Santa Clara County. So some of the terms that we used out there are a little different than what you use here. But she was speaking at the meeting. So she was telling a bit of her story and then leading the discussion. And I sat down, and this nun's name was Bonnie Rock. And the reason I say that is because Bonnie would always use her full name, and she wouldn't mind. But I went, I drank with her. But I drank with her when she was at the end of her career, and I was just beginning mine. And I thought, God, if she can get sober, maybe, just maybe. But I will tell you, I walked in the rooms, and you guys hugged too much, you're way too jolly, and everybody expected me to trust them. And I don't trust people. I don't trust you, or you. Or you, and I sure as heck don't trust you. And there's no way that I could see how those steps had anything to do with my getting sober. Because I hadn't planned on getting sober. That was not why I came in. I came in because of suicide. But out of that first meeting, I came away with a sponsor and a big book. And just a tiny bit of hope. And I started off on this journey called sobriety. And, you know, the truth of the matter is, everybody tells you you ought to be willing and all this stuff. I wasn't willing. I did every single step begrudgingly. I didn't like them. The things that I was asked to do made me uncomfortable. They made me mad. I fired my sponsor every single day. I called her names that no one should be called. And the next day we'd start again and do the same thing all over. I went to a lot of meetings. And it's interesting because my sponsor had moved to Santa Clara County about 6 weeks before I got sober. She has 15 years more sobriety than I do. She's also 15 years younger than I am. So it made for an interesting dynamic. But she asked me to take her to meetings. She said, I'm not sure where all these places are. You know the area. Why don't you drive me? It wasn't till I was 5 years sober, because sometimes I'm slow on stuff, that I realized that she had GPS and knew where all those meetings are because she'd been going to them for 6 weeks. And it was her way of spending time with me just to get to know me. I'm a slow learner. But the thing is that in those early meetings, meeting number two for me, they were doing rotation of service. And so rotation of service means that they're electing new people to do stuff. And in this particular meeting, a service commitment is 6 months long. And so I'm sitting there in the front row, because my sponsor always had me sit in the front row. She said, in the hospital, the really sick people are in the ICU. And you're sicker than most, so I want you up front so I can see you. So that's still where I sit. I sit in the front. And in that second meeting, they were doing rotation of service elections, and all of a sudden they needed somebody to clean ashtrays, and the next thing I know, my sponsor has my hand up like this. And I'm going, what are you doing? And she says, well, it's about time you started giving back. I said, giving back what? And she said, what's so freely been given to you? Because I hadn't had a drink for a day. So I cleaned ashtrays for 6 months. And then they thought that it would be a good idea if I made coffee. And this is making coffee for about 150 people. And that's fine. I know how to make coffee. They gave me very precise directions. They said, you do this, you do this, you do it at this time, and this time. And I went, right, gotcha. Next Saturday I showed up, and I made coffee my way. And one of the old-timers walked in, always the first one in the room, always did the meeting before the meeting, took that first sip of coffee and threw out everything I'd made and remade it. And I was removed from coffee service because apparently I didn't know how to follow directions, which is part of my problem as an alcoholic. I think I know best. It's that portion of 60 to 63. You know, I'm selfish, self-centered, driven by 100 forms of fear. I want what I want when I want it, and it's your job to give it to me. And I think that I, with my best of intentions, can step on your toes by telling you how you should live your life and do what I need to have done. So they kept me on ashtrays for a year and a half. And then they said, maybe, just maybe, you can follow directions. And so I listened very carefully, and the directions hadn't changed, but I paid attention, and I made coffee the way they asked me to make it, and I got off of ashtray duty, which was a good thing. You know, I will tell you, if you're a newcomer here, even if you aren't a newcomer, sobriety isn't necessarily easy. Things in life happen that challenge you on a daily basis. And my first year of sobriety, actually the first 2.5 years, sucked. I hated it. There were times that I thought, my God, why did you get me sober? Because it just, you know, I wasn't drinking. I'd worked my steps, and I was doing service, and I was not trudging. I was slogging, because it just, things were happening in my life that just challenged me in ways that I was not happy, joyous, and free. You know, at about 9 months sober, my then husband filed divorce papers on me, which probably turned out to be a good thing, but it was an arduous 7.5 year process. And it just, I knew it was coming, but I didn't know it was coming. You know, I didn't think he'd really go through with it. And from there, things got worse. I had two sets of health issues that put me in hospital twice that year. And I was struggling with recovering from those things and doing outpatient procedures that needed to follow up. And I didn't have any energy. I felt like dying. And I thought, oh my God, is this supposed to be what sobriety is? But I learned something early in the roots, and it was the old timers who always said it to me. They go, don't drink, keep coming back, it'll change. They never promised me it would get better. They promised me it would get different. And that's a good thing, because if they told me it would get better, I would have had an expectation that I should have had something that maybe I wasn't supposed to have yet. So I kept going to meetings, and I kept doing service, and kept talking with my sponsor. We went through the steps in about 2 months. And it took 2 months because the first month she had me call her every day and pick her up to go to a meeting because she wanted to see if I could follow directions. And that first Thanksgiving that I was sober, so I'm only a couple months sober, I had to make my final amends, other than living amends, to my mom. And my mom lived in Fresno, and my daughter and I went over for Thanksgiving because my then husband, my husband, didn't want to come. And I had to make an amends to her. And I kept telling my sponsor, you don't understand, she's going to rip me a new one because she's not going to like this. And that's really uncomfortable, and it's going to make me drink. And she finally got sick of hearing me say that. She slapped a 20 on the table and said, well, here, that's a good start. And I looked at the 20, and I said, that won't even give me enough to get me started. And she said, well, then put your big girl panties on and do what I'm suggesting. So I made my amends to my mom, and it went just about the way I thought. Not all amends go well. But when I was done, I was done. And on the way home, my then 9-year-old daughter looks at me and says, something's different. She noticed a change, even though it didn't feel like there'd been a change to me. It is things like that throughout my sobriety that have always brought me to a standstill, because I think I know exactly the way my life should be going. I think I understand myself very well. You know, I'm an adult child of an alcoholic, and I did all that work before I ever started drinking. Didn't keep me from being a drunk. You know, I knew who God was before I walked in the rooms. Didn't keep me from being a drunk. You know, I suffer from an obsession of the mind and an allergy of the body. And once I take that drink, I crave, and I will do anything to get the next drink. And when I say anything, I will do anything to any of you, and I don't care what the consequences are, because I have to have that drink. And that's just the truth of my alcoholism. So we worked the steps, and there I am in service, and I'm going to lots of meetings because I can. And really, the truth of the matter is, I was going to lots of meetings because it was a place where I knew I wouldn't drink. I was 2.5 years sober, sitting in a meeting I usually went to on Tuesday night. And this young lady sitting next to me opened her water bottle, and I went, whoa, vodka. It never dawned on me that people would put booze into their water bottle in order to come to an AA meeting. You know, there are things you learn. It's a good thing I didn't learn that earlier. I might not have ever gotten sober. I looked at her and I went, really? And she said, well, yeah, everybody does that. And I went, I'll trade you. She wouldn't give it up. I figured she wouldn't. But the truth is that there are fun times in sobriety. Early on, I got drugged to things like picnics. They go, we're having a picnic, so why don't you come along? Oh, you have to bring a side dish too. And I'd go, why would I want to do that? You know, because I had essentially thought I had a wonderful life. I was president of the PTA. I monitored the clay projects for the kids at school. I was a room mom. I coached my kids' softball team. I had it going on. Except I had no friends. And people didn't really want to be around me. It's after the softball game, you know how everybody kind of decides to go out for pizza and stuff? People wouldn't tell me where they were going for pizza. They'd say, we'll bring Victoria back home when afterwards. And I was fine with that. I was fine with that. Because I didn't like you guys anyway. So you can imagine coming into AA and all you touchy, happy people want me to go to a picnic with you. And my sponsor said, I'm going to that picnic. I need a ride. And why don't you pick me up at about 11 o'clock? So I learned how to go to picnics. And you know what I learned out of that? I could go sit in the corner and be all by myself and you people wouldn't leave me alone. Well, you're new here, aren't you? I haven't seen you before. You weren't at our last picnic. You must not have very much sobriety. And all I wanted to do was go F yourself. The idea that I knew how to do a relationship did not exist in my early sobriety. The truth of the matter is, the only relationship I had was with a bottle. I knew how to have a relationship with a bottle. I thought I did relationships really well, because I was a mom, and I was married, and I was president of the PTA, and I coached softball, and don't you know. I did not know how to treat people. I didn't know how to trust people. I did not know how to unblock this rigidness that kept me protected all my life. You know, growing up in an alcoholic home, you learn to protect yourself because you have to. And that leaves me with a lot of little kid stuff that leaves me very protected. And the idea that I would just open up to anybody and everybody, that's one way that people do it. They have no filter. They share everything with everybody. And that wasn't me. I had a hard time sharing with my sponsor. I didn't have a hard time doing the fourth step because that was all stuff that was in the past. But to talk about who I was, to talk about the things I cared about, to talk about the idea that there might be some future life that I wanted things to be different, that's a step too far. How dare you ask me something that personal? I'm really good at telling jokes. I'm really good at making people laugh. But to share the deep innermost parts of me is not something I feel comfortable doing, even to this day. But little by slow, at places like these picnics where they'd come up to me and say, well, you're kind of new here, aren't you? And then they'd go, that's not bad potato salad you made. You know, sometimes when we make potato salad, and they'd tell me the way they'd like it, and I'd go, yeah, I'm not doing that. Because potato salad is one of the things I like to make, and I like it my way. And that one I could do. I could say, well, you don't have to eat that. In an AA meeting, everybody drinks coffee, so I have to do it their way. Little by slow, went on camping trips and went rafting down the American River and would go to night meetings on the Monterey Bay coast. And I started to develop friendships, at least superficially, with people in the room where I would, before the meeting, we'd all sit and yak. And after the meeting, a lot of the times we'd go out for food or coffee and we'd have a good time. But it took me a while to figure that one out, too, on a Friday night meeting. Everybody went out to Bob's Big Boy. If you aren't old enough to know it, Bob's, too bad. They have great French fried onion rings. And so this whole group of people from this meeting would go, yeah, we're going to Bob's. And so they'd go over to Bob's Big Boy. And I said to my sponsor, they never give me an invitation. And she said, have you ever asked if you could go? And I went, why would I do that? They're all saying, oh, I'm going over here, won't you come? I said, why do I have to ask? And she said, well, just try it and see what happens. So I went up to Gary Smith. And Gary Smith was one of the old-timers in the meeting. I said, okay if I, you know, like a little four-year-old. He said, okay if I come to Bob's with you tonight? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, you guys hadn't given me an invitation. And he said, oh, God. He said, we don't give anybody an invitation. These are people who'd been going to that meeting long enough that they knew they were going to dinner or something afterwards, and so they just wanted to know where the meeting place was. Well, we're going to Bob's. Sometimes they didn't go to Bob's, and then they went somewhere else. I had to learn to ask to be included. And that's the hardest, one of the hardest lessons I had to, because I had to open myself up to rejection. Right? What if they said no? What if they said, well, you know, this is kind of a special, private, small celebration, and you're not invited? That's happened to me in the roots of AA. Early in my sobriety, that would have broken my heart. And that would have made me say, see, I knew you guys weren't trustworthy. I knew you didn't really care about me. I knew that what you were trying to tell me about sobriety really doesn't play out in the real world. But not everybody in the rooms is here for the same reason, and I didn't develop those kinds of friendships with people with just everybody in the room. You know, there were certain people that for whatever reason, like Denise says, you know, they were there before the meeting. And when I'd show up, we'd kind of talk a little bit. And some of those people I just really connected with, and some I did not. And that was okay. And the people I connected with, I began to develop relationship with. And those people tell me these days that I am their friend. You know, the Big Book calls us to be a friend among friends, a worker among workers. Those are things I did not know how to do when I walked in here. I thought I knew, because I was 45 years old, and my God, I knew how to tie my shoes and get out of bed and hold a job. I had no clue. I was very angry when I walked in the rooms of AA. And you guys, little by slow, knocked all the edges off me. You kind of rounded me out so that I was a little smoother and a little more presentable. You know, at about 5 years sober, I called my sponsor because I was having this really recurring dream, and it concerned me because it was about anger. And I know that the Big Book tells me that anger is not something that alcoholics have any good right to hold on to. And so I said, you know, I had this recurring dream where I take a softball bat and beat my then husband to death, because we were still in the process of divorce, and it was getting nasty, and I was just fed up, and the dream was visceral. I mean, I really beat him to death, and I'd wake up in the morning and oh God, that feels so good. And my sponsor just laughed, and she said, oh, this is wonderful. And I went, what? I said, I'm angry. This is happening. I know that's not good for an alcoholic. She said, no, this is perfect. She said, you're making real progress. She said, you came in suicidal, and now you're homicidal. You are becoming less self-centered. The truth of the matter is that it took me a while to appreciate the fact that she was right. I was becoming less self-centered. Thinking of ways to kill your ex is not usually the way that manifests, but in my case it did. It, you know, it is those kinds of lessons, because of their bizarreness, that I appreciate about the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Some of you who may be newer to the rooms or not have as much sobriety may kind of discount the old-timers because, you know, we're crotchety, we repeat the same stories or the same message over and over and over again because we know that's what works. Because my forgetter is really active. Why do you think we read how it works every single time? It's because we don't know how it works. And I need to be reminded. I need to be reminded. Because you know, I can read that, and every time I read it, something different pops out, and I go, oh yeah, I forgot that. Half measures availed us nothing. You know what? Most of my life, half measures availed me something. I got half a loaf. Sometimes I got a whole loaf. It just, I could put in, you know, C-level effort and sometimes get an A. Not in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. If I don't do the entire set, if I'm not willing to do the interior work that Alcoholics Anonymous challenges me to do, then I don't get anything. I end up drunk and under a bridge and in a cardboard condo, squeezing sterno through a cheesecloth trying to get the shakes to come off, and I die there. I don't die quick, though. For this alcoholic, you know if I take another drink, because I'm sober, and today I won't take a drink because I've done what I need to do to not take a drink today. But if I were to ever take a drink again, I wouldn't die quick. I'm not that lucky. You know, God has a sense of humor. He likes to toy with me, and I can't blame him because I'm a hard-headed learner. I know I would be one of those who would die in misery, and it would take long periods of time, and I would go little by slow, and I would hate every moment of life. And that's sufficient misery to keep me from wanting to pick up a drink today. You know, at 10 years sober, I had a recurrence of the health issues I had in my first year of sobriety. And I was about 45, 50 pounds thinner than I am now. And the doctor suggested to me that I probably ought to contact all my family and friends and let them know that I was not doing well. His definition of doing well was I had about 3 to 4 months to live. So get your affairs in order. And so I picked up my 10-year chip. I was just overwhelmed with the fact that I was 10 years sober. But people had been noticing that I hadn't been feeling well, and I hadn't shared with I'd shared with a couple of my friends, but I had not shared at meeting level that I was that sick. And but if you're in AA long enough, you know full well that the AA grapevine runs at about bullet speed on the express train because the rumors just run like mad. And so people would come up to me and go, you know, we're praying for you. And after about 2 months of that, I just got really tired of it. At that meeting, I was asked to share. And I said, I know you guys are all praying for me. You think there's going to be some miracle. And that's true. I believe in miracles. I've seen them happen in the rooms. I said, but really, I'm tired, and I'm sick, and I don't feel good, and all you're doing is keeping me here. So please don't pray for me. After that meeting, my really good friend, who's a nurse practitioner, pulled me aside and said, well, you know, Jane, you may be finished with us, and God may be finished with you, but we aren't finished with you. We still have things that we have to hear you say. And they call them Jainisms. And everybody who's been around the Howe place knows about Pat Wheeler and stuff that he used to say. That happens at every place, every meeting. There's some old-timer that you go, yeah, they always used to say that. And I just looked at her and I said, well, isn't that interesting? And something clicked. Something changed in my attitude, in my outlook. I mean, it was the same kind of shift that happened when I came in and decided I was going to do the 12 steps. Is that all of a sudden I quit being busy dying. I quit being busy being scared. I quit wondering whether today is the day. Is today the day? Am I going to die today? And my appetite didn't come back real quick. I was still losing weight. Things were still starting to look kind of desperate. And Dina said to me, you know, it's my experience, because she's a nurse practitioner, she does home care. She takes care of those people who are on hospice and gerontology, diseases of the aging veteran. She says, I have seen families who don't do well when their loved ones don't let them know how sick they are. And she told me this because my daughter was off at Dahlonega, then called North Georgia College and State University, going to nursing school. And I didn't want to tell her because I didn't want her to have to come home, because there was nothing to come home for. It's not like she was going to take care of me, because I had friends who would take care of me. And Dina said, you know, you owe her a call, because it's not fair to her to not let her know what's going on. And I explained why I wasn't doing it, and she said, yeah, give her a call. And I will tell you, that's the hardest call I've ever made in my life. And I didn't tell her outright that I was dying. What I said was, I've lost a lot of weight. The doctor is frustrated with me because I don't want to do a lot of the tests that he wants done, because I've already been through those twice. I know what they are. It wouldn't make any difference because I wasn't going to do the kind of treatment he wanted anyway. So the information I had was I'd lost a lot of weight and the doctor was concerned. And I told her that because that was the truth. But I knew what was going on in my body. And we talked a while. And I told her, I said, I want you to know how proud I am of you and how much you mean to me. And no matter what happens, I want you to finish school. Well, that went, see, stupid me, that went, danger, Will Robinson, your mom's sick as all get out. This was not a nice, you know, my kid knows me. So after I hung up, she immediately called Dina, because they're good friends, and Dina called me later and said, Victoria wanted to come home and take care of you. And I said, I'm sure she did. And she said, I talked her out of it. And I said, good. And from that moment forward, you know, I found a song by Tim McGraw called Live Like You Were Dying. And it became my theme song. You know, I learned to speak sweeter. And I learned to love deeper. And I learned to forgive like the dying do. And I would play that loud when I was going to meetings and I was out on the freeway. And all of a sudden, I could keep food down, and I started to put weight back on. And whatever Chinese herbal stuff I was doing seemed to have kicked in. And obviously, I didn't die in 3 to 4 months, because I'm here today talking to you. And I learned something about living 24 hours at a time. And I learned something about myself, which is that when I live in fear, my life goes in the crapper. I can be happy no matter what my circumstances, because I learned in rooms like this that happiness is a choice. You know, at 16 years sober, I got laid off from my last high-tech job because I lived in California because I did high-tech work. And when I was talking to my daughter, who, after she got, after she graduated from college, married the young Georgian that she'd fell in love with at college. And so they live out here. And she said, "Mom, why don't you come be closer to family?" Well, okay, that's a good reason to leave. But, my job prospects were not looking good at the time just because of the cycle of high-tech, the way high-tech goes. So I took an early retirement and came out here in May of 2013. And the first meeting I went to was at the Howe Place on a Thursday night. And, you know, they asked if there was anybody who was new to the Howe Place. And I stood, and I introduced myself, and I said, "I'm new to the area from California. I said, I know I can adjust to a lot of the differences that your meetings have, but where I came from, everybody stands to speak, and I don't know that I can break that habit." And Tom said, "You don't have to." And I said, "Well, I guess I've found home." And I still stand. Because, you know, the truth of the matter is, I spent a lot of years sitting around drinking, telling lies to myself and to everybody else. And when I stand, you hold me accountable. You can hear me. You can see my eyes. I can see yours. So I still stand when I share. It makes some people uncomfortable. And I hope they talk to their sponsor about it. It's not my purpose to make them uncomfortable. They can come talk to me about it. That I've learned in AA. When I have an issue with somebody, I'm better off talking to them than not. You know, the lessons of sobriety have been bittersweet. This year, in September, obviously, I celebrated 20 years. I became an official old-timer. Didn't drink, didn't die. That's the key. But I got sober in rooms where I walked in and people had 15, 20, 30, 40 years of sobriety. I've gone to funerals of people who've had 55, 60, 62 years of sobriety. The old-timers taught me how to live. The steps showed me who I was, and I didn't want to see that. It was the old-timers who by modeling their behavior, who taking the time to kind of whisper in my ear when I wasn't behaving well, and then they'd tap me on the shoulder, and then they'd take me out back after the meeting and let me know that sober people don't behave like this, you need to change. Help direct me so I could grow up. They modeled for me what sober people looked like. And I can't tell you how important that is. There are people in the rooms who have lots of sobriety that I don't want anything they have. And then there are other people who may not have as much sobriety and I want everything they have. And I get to make those choices today. And I get to do it with a clear head and a clear mind. And I'm going to finish with a story that I always finish my speaker meetings with because I've been told I have to. My daughter, as I mentioned, is a nurse. Well, I may not have mentioned that. My daughter is a nurse. She currently is an ICU nurse. But when she first got out of nursing school, she got a job at a place that's an Alzheimer's hospice center. And she worked mid shifts, which usually means 2 to 11 or midnight. And she used to give me phone calls in California because she knew I'd be up just so she could kind of data dump and decompress. It's because her husband, who is an IT engineer, is a very literal thinker, and she'd come home and try and talk to him about folks who had passed on. And he'd look at her and he'd go, "They're old, they're sick, they die. What's your problem?" Not quite what she needed in order to kind of, you know, deal with the emotionality of it. And some of the phone calls were just agonizing. Like one night, the very first time she had to call a code, and she started CPR, this little 90-year-old woman, the sternum broke and cascade of some broken ribs. You can hear that when you make the compression. And all my daughter could do when I answered the phone, all I could hear was that deep breath that one takes before you start sobbing uncontrollably. And I sat for about 5 minutes just listening to that. And I learned how to do that here in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't have to fix it. I didn't have to interrupt. All I had to do was honor it and value it for the moment it was. And then she could tell me what happened. And then there were some more amusing things, like the night she called and she was still chuckling. And she said, "Oh, Mom, I love my people." I said, "What happened?" She said, "Mrs. A was down in her room going, 'Help me, help me, I've gone blind. Won't somebody please help me?'" And my daughter goes down to the room and looks inside the door and says, "Mrs. A, your eyes are closed." It's an Alzheimer's. Mrs. A says, "Oh God, please help me. Isn't somebody there? I've gone blind. Help me." And so my daughter says, "I'm going to stroke your cheek." And she walked over across the room and gently stroked the woman's cheek. And her eyes popped open and she grabbed my daughter's wrist and she said, "Oh, thank God you were here. You know, I was blind and couldn't see." My daughter was so thrilled with that. And I loved that story because it's the kind of compassionate care that my daughter routinely gives. And it's the kind of care I wish everybody would receive whenever they're in hospital or need that kind of care. But, you know, that story ran around my head for 10 days. And it was when I was sharing at a meeting, and I was standing in front of folks like you, and it dawned on me. That's my life in AA. So frequently I am blind and I cannot see. And you touch me, and my eyes open, and I get a chance to thank God. It's a moment of grace. And then that always reminds me of the hymn that I heard from earliest days. "Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, and now am found, was blind, and now I see." Thank you for 12-stepping me today.